This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, August 6, 2008. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. ICE kicks off a new program that asks undocumented people to turn themselves in for self-deportation.
ICE is not really offering anybody anything as incentive to turn themselves in, so I don't understand why they think anybody would turn themselves in.
We'll hear from Gaza and Hamas's closure of dozens of community-based NGOs. Plus, President Bush wraps up his trip to South Korea to discuss a free trade deal amid continued protests.
President Lee can continue to be pro-American, but he has to be much more intuitive to domestic political currents.
Those stories and more after this news.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Guantanamo Bay's first military commissions trial has ended in a conviction for Osama bin Laden's former driver. Salim Hamdan was found guilty of providing material support for terrorism by a panel of military officers. He was acquitted on one count of conspiracy. Unlike the U.S. criminal justice system, the military commission system allows for the use of secret evidence, hearsay, and statements made under coercion or provoked by interrogation methods considered by most Western countries to be torture. Hamdan faces a life sentence. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. has ordered the unsealing of documents related to the wave of anthrax attacks in the fall of 2001. Naji Mujahid has more on the story.
The D.C. District Court ordered the release of about 65 sets of lengthy FBI documents that included affidavits, search warrants, and attachments that the agency had gathered for its case against the alleged anthrax culprit, Bruce Ivins. The court order comes after the apparent suicide of Ivins, the Army scientist that the FBI claims was its primary suspect in the attacks. Ivins died after a medication overdose last week. In a review of the documents, they lay out six reasons as to why he's a suspect and point to possible uncontrollable mental behavior. Some are skeptical of Ivins' culpability, accusing the government of using the dead man as a fall guy in order to close the case. Just last month, the government agreed to a multi-million dollar settlement for defamation of character with bioweapons expert Stephen Hatfield, a former colleague of Ivins and someone the FBI had previously identified as a person of interest in the case. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Naji Mujahid of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
The White House has denied allegations made by a Pulitzer Prize-winning author that the Bush administration ordered former CIA Director George Tenet to produce forged documents in order to create a fake link between the 9/11 attacks and the regime of former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. The claims appear in the new book, The Way of the World, by Ron Siskind. White House Deputy Press Secretary Tony Fratto called the allegations absurd. In the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, the White House had claimed that the Hussein regime had provided support for 9/11 hijacker Mohammed Atta, although this claim was never supported by any credible evidence. Senior military figures staged a coup today in Mauritania, taking the elected president and prime minister into custody. The West African country has lived through more than 10 coups since winning its independence from France in 1960. The senior military officials that took power today had recently been fired by the president and included the former head of the Presidential Guard. In other news, social conflicts are raging across Bolivia just days before President Evo Morales and provincial governors face a recall referendum. Aldo Orellano has more from Cochabamba.
Protests led by public sector workers turned deadly yesterday when police opened fire on miners blocking a major interstate highway. Two miners were killed and another 34 were injured. The workers had been blockading the highway for 2 days as part of nationwide mobilizations to call on the government to reform the country's social security system. A few hours after police broke up the highway blockade, protesters took over the airport in the city of Tarija, forcing the cancellation of a summit President Morales was scheduled to hold with his Argentine and Venezuelan counterparts. The protesters in Tarija are allied with a conservative movement in Bolivia's gas-rich provinces. The opposition-led governments in the gas-rich provinces oppose a national program that channels gas royalties away from local governments and into public assistance programs for senior citizens. Despite the conflicts in various parts of the country, Morales says the recall referendum will proceed as planned on August 10. The referendum is expected to favor Morales and weaken the right-wing opposition. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lenny Oliveira in Cochabamba, Bolivia.
Across South Africa today, thousands of workers staged a massive one-day strike to protest rising energy, food, and fuel prices, which workers say are pushing them into poverty. Miners, auto manufacturing workers, and textile employees were just some of the workers taking to the streets and forcing the shutdown of their employers' operations. Students stayed home from school, and public transportation was also suspended in some areas. Amid a strong police presence, thousands rallied in the capital, Pretoria, and in Cape Town carrying signs that read, "Say no to the high food prices," and "My take-home salary is not even enough to take me home." The 2-million-member Congress of South African Trade Unions says the strike is a warning to employers. The union is demanding pay raises and is pressuring President Thabo Mbeki to provide subsidies for basic goods. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
President Bush wrapped up a 2-day visit to South Korea today. His meeting with President Lee Myung-bak was originally scheduled for last month, but pushed back because of massive protests against U.S. beef imports. Although demonstrations continue, the two leaders focused their talks on passing a free trade agreement and address North Korea's nuclear program. FSRN's Jason Strother has the story from Seoul.
Bush was greeted upon his arrival on Tuesday by throngs of protesters in downtown Seoul. Demonstrators denouncing a trade deal to import U.S. beef clashed with riot police. Around 160 people were arrested overnight. Opponents of U.S. beef imports say President Lee Myung-bak has opened excessive U.S. imports. Even though the beef issue is still a divisive topic in South Korea, the rallies have not deterred either leader from supporting a bilateral free trade agreement, FTA, which still needs to be ratified by lawmakers in both nations. In Seoul, the trade bill has bipartisan backing, but in Washington, there is still strong opposition from those who say the deal is unfair to American laborers, especially in the automotive industry. President Bush assured President Lee that he will do all he can to press skeptics of the FTA.
And it's an important agreement for the United States. It's important for our businesses, it's important for our workers, and our Congress must get this agreement done and ratify it. I'm going to push hard for it.
But after months of protest, the Lee administration has been weakened by labor strikes and an opposition party-led parliamentary boycott. If Lee wants to regain public support, say political analysts, he can no longer be seen as too cozy with Washington. Lee Chung-min is an international relations professor at Yonsei University.
I think President Lee can continue to be pro-American, but he has to be much more intuitive to domestic political currents. There are huge political costs and hurdles, as he obviously has seen for the last several months. He will pursue a very pro-U.S., pro-global Korea foreign policy, but he also realizes that he has to tread water very carefully.
But an area where Lee does have popular support is bringing an end to North Korea's nuclear weapons program. In June, Pyongyang handed over a long-awaited declaration of its plutonium-enriching facilities and materials. But the negotiations have reached another roadblock. There's been no agreement on how to verify that the disclosure is complete and accurate. Lee Chung-min says that President Bush cannot stop short of anything except full verification if he wants support from lawmakers back home.
This is the most important issue over the North Korean nuclear problem, and that's something that Lee Myung-bak and the administration will continue to pursue from a South Korean perspective.
If Congress eventually accepts that Pyongyang has been fully forthcoming, Washington could remove North Korea from the sanctions-bearing list of states that sponsor terrorism. This would allow the reclusive nation to receive international investment. But some human rights activists here in Seoul say that now is not the time for the Kim Jong-il regime to be delisted. Campaigners held a rally in front of the U.S. Embassy prior to Bush's arrival. Do-hee Yoon, president of the Citizens Coalition for Human Rights of Abductees and North Korean Refugees, says that North Korea is still the world's greatest terrorist threat. North Korea has kidnapped people from many other countries, not just South Korea, Do says. This is a clear example of terrorist activity. If these people are not returned home, how can North Korea be removed off the terrorism sponsor list? The joint statement released following the Bush-Lee summit states that both leaders agree that North Korea must address human rights concerns if relations are to be normalized. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea.
Israeli officials released five Lebanese teenaged prisoners today as part of a prisoner swap that began last month with Hezbollah. The youth were allegedly detained for throwing stones and other objects. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert agreed to release some 150 more Palestinian prisoners later this month after meeting today with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Israeli human rights groups estimate that Israel holds some 8,500 Palestinians in jail in Israel, including an estimated 300 minors. Abbas and Palestinian negotiators are requesting the release of Marwan Barghouti, who Israel sentenced to jail for life, and the release of Ahmed Sadat, a leader of the group Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Meanwhile, in the Gaza Strip, the Hamas-dominated government has ordered the closure of dozens of community-based NGOs, sports clubs, and Fatah offices. The closures follow a recent car blast that claimed the lives of three Hamas fighters. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari is in Gaza with more.
According to the Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights in Gaza, 179 local NGOs, including those providing services to children and people with disabilities, have been sealed off by the Hamas's interior ministry. This week, the Hamas forces broke into and confiscated equipment from scores of NGOs in the Gaza Strip in what the ministry says is a crackdown on suspicious organizations that have been attempting to destabilize internal security. Ni'man al-Rifi is the director of the Shu'a Palestinian Youth Development Society. He says Hamas confiscated 18 computers before their office was closed by the Interior Ministry.
This is an inhumane act because the society is assuming a human duty which serves the local community as a whole, regardless of its religious or political background. It is a benevolent institution that has nothing to do with any factional activities.
The Gaza-based Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights considers the closures illegal and demands a clear-cut justification from the Hamas government. Samir Zakut is the spokesperson for the Al-Mizan Center in Gaza.
In a large number of these cases, those who broke into the institutions did not show a legal warrant to enter these places or confiscate their contents. We believe that what happened was totally inconsistent with the law, as repressive measures have been taken. Therefore, we believe that the incentive was the underlying political division. On the other hand, we have noticed retaliatory political action by the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, as a large-scale arrest campaign was carried out against Hamas's supporters there.
Hamas denies any linkage between the closure of NGOs and the current split with Fatah Party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. The ministry argues that its recent measures were intended to diffuse more internal unrest in the shadow of last week's Friday blast. Ihab al-Hussein is the spokesperson for the Interior Ministry in Gaza.
For more than a year now, the Ramallah Authority has been cracking down on Hamas's supporters or closing Hamas-linked institutions, yet we and the Palestinian government have not reacted by doing the same. We have not closed Fatah's institutions completely. On the contrary, Fatah has been acting freely. It used to hold conferences, and just 1 week ago, it concluded its internal elections. What we have done was due to the fact that sabotaging attempts have reached the climax, towards which we cannot keep silent.
The rival Fatah and Hamas parties have been at loggerheads since Hamas came to power following the 2006 parliamentary elections. In June 2007, the Islamic Hamas took over the coastal territory and ejected the secular Fatah loyal security forces. 1 month later, President Abbas outlawed Hamas and installed a Fatah loyal government in the West Bank, and since then, dialogue between the rival parties has been stalled. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Mirari in Gaza.
A new report released by Public Research Associates analyzes the conditions that have given rise to a battle that's pitting the Christian right against undocumented immigrants. Basing their crusade on the principle that the United States was founded as a Christian country, the new breed of Christian right voters maintains that those who stand in contrast to so-called established American beliefs pose a threat to Christian ideology, and that the deportation of undocumented immigrants is consistent with Christian doctrine. Tarso Luis Ramos is the research director for Public Research Associates, the Boston-based progressive think tank that released the report. Ramos says that the Christian right has only recently begun demonizing undocumented immigrants.
Well, the first thing I would say is that it's difficult to speak about the Christian right as a whole. And in fact, until very recently, you would be hard-pressed to find a Christian right leader who was speaking out forcefully on the issue of immigration. The Christian right is the largest social movement in the United States, representing, just as an example, maybe between 10 and 13% of the electorate in a major, say, presidential year election, is a very large movement, and it contains within its ranks many people who hold nativist ideas about immigrants and are strongly anti-immigrant. But in some ways, the story here is that there's been a shift, and the leadership of some key Christian right organizations have been following their flock, if you will, taking signals from their own base, and hardening their position on immigration, whereas in the past they've always kept arm's length distance from that issue.
You say that the topic of illegal immigration is now as important for the Christian right as is abortion and same-sex marriage. How did it get to be like this so quickly?
Well, it's beginning to rank close to the top of their list of issues. Let me give you a sense of the shift that's happened in recent years. Every year, the key Christian right organizations hold a national political summit in Washington, inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C., called the Values Voters Summit. Last year, Mike Pence, a member of the House Conservative Caucus, who was a speaker there, had this to say about immigration. He said, "You should not mistreat the alien in your midst, for you yourselves were aliens in Egypt. There is for the believer no asterisk, no exception." And here he's quoting from the Bible. He's quoting from Exodus. The next year, in 2007, so that was in 2006, Mike Huckabee, then a presidential hopeful, in response to the question why the U.S. is importing so many immigrant workers, had to say this: "It might be because for the last 35 years, we've aborted more than 1 million people, that's each year, who would have been in our workforce had we not had the Holocaust of liberalized abortion under a flawed Supreme Court ruling in 1973. So you see this incredible distance that was traversed in the span of a single year at this major confab of the Christian right on the issue of immigration, from trying to declare or take a position of tolerance towards immigrants, towards linking illegal immigration to perhaps the core issue of the Christian right, which is abortion, and suggesting that illegal immigration into the United States is largely responsible for high rates of abortion in the United States. That's an incredible shift.
What about this idea of the threat to so-called American values? You write in your report about Christian nationalism, white nationalism, and nativism. Can you tell us how these relate back to the anti-immigrant backlash?
Sure. There is a strong thread, I would say, in American culture in general, but particularly in certain segments of the Christian right who see themselves as Christian nationalists and really focus on this idea that the United States was founded as a Christian nation based on Christian values. There's an incredible resistance and perception of threat that the culture of the United States is changing as a result of widespread immigration, that there is a double kind of threat because many of the immigrants, that is Latino immigrants coming mostly across the southern border, to say nothing of Asians for a moment, are not only not European, but they're also Catholic. And we see in the current anti-immigrant backlash, certainly within sectors of the Christian right, a similar kind of anti-Catholicism as we saw in earlier waves of nativist resentment in the United States, often led by conservative evangelical Protestants.
Tarso Luis Ramos is the research director for Political Research Associates. The Department of Homeland Security has kicked off a test program offering some undocumented immigrants an opportunity to turn themselves in to be deported. Immigration advocates question the purpose of the program. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, calls their new program Operation Scheduled Departure. It's launched in 5 cities: Chicago, Charlotte, San Diego, Santa Ana, and Phoenix. Immigrants who have already undergone deportation proceedings but have yet to leave the country can voluntarily turn themselves in. The incentive, says ICE, avoiding arrest and detention.
This allows you to have some degree of involvement and control over your removal.
Kelly Nantel is an ICE spokesperson.
We're willing to work with you. We're willing to help you secure your travel documents, make your arrangements, plan for your return so that it's not abrupt.
The program started Tuesday and will last for 3 weeks. So far, only one person living in Phoenix has turned himself in. About 500,000 people are avoiding deportation orders. D.C.-based immigration attorney Crystal Williams doesn't know what to make of the program.
I'm not really sure why they've announced such a thing and why they're doing it. Anybody can leave at any time, so they don't need the assistance or to pass through ICE in order to leave. ICE is not really offering anybody anything as incentive to turn themselves in. So I don't understand why they think anybody would turn themselves in. I'm sure there'll be one or two people. If they get more than 5 people out of this, I'll be surprised. It's a very curious thing to even bother to announce.
ICE's Kelly Nantel says the search for those who skirt order deportation will continue.
Every day, our fugitive operation teams are out there. We are seeking to identify, locate, arrest, detain, and deport fugitive aliens. And that hasn't changed. We're out there today. We'll be out there tomorrow and every day beyond that. So for, people who are tired of looking over their shoulders and wondering if today's the day, this is a program that they should look into.
ICE says they have 92 teams working in local communities around the country searching for immigrants who have avoided deportation orders. Federal funding will add 12 more of these operation teams next year. But some immigrant rights activists say federal officials are once again implementing immigration policies that don't work. Latino organizer Emma Lozano is president of the People Without Borders and member of the United Methodist Church in Chicago.
I could not in good conscience, as a human being and as a Christian, tell people, turn yourself in. Why would you disrupt your family, because many of the people that will be asked to leave are the principal breadwinners of their families. So, as a Christian, I would not be able to, in good faith, tell them that that is a resolution to follow a broken law.
This program will last until August 22nd. After that, it will be evaluated and possibly expanded. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. FSRN has brought you uncensored news from the U.S. and around the world every weekday for more than 7 years. We're proud of our history of challenging old models of media access and control by highlighting the voices of marginalized communities most affected by social and economic policy changes. Now, a large funding cut and economic hard times jeopardize our ability to continue producing a daily newscast. You can visit us online at fsrn.org to find out more about how you can help keep us on the air. That's fsrn.org. The United States hit the highest unemployment rate in more than 4 years this July, reaching 5.7%. Since the beginning of the year, there have been more than 400,000 job losses. These figures translate to nearly 9 million unemployed people. And even these numbers could rise as automakers, banks, airlines, and state and local governments pursue layoffs and cut back on hiring. Also on the chopping block, jobs for youth. Teenage unemployment jumped to 19%. That's the highest rate in 16 years. Keep in mind that the federal unemployment statistics only consider people actively looking for work and not those who may have already given up. It also excludes the self-employed who may be experiencing weeks or months without steady work.
So what's it like for the millions of people trying to secure a job in this economic climate? For our new regular segment, Street Beat, FSRN reporter Emily Reddy gathered the stories of some Floridians visiting the Tampa Bay Workforce Alliance, which provides employment assistance. There were about 30 people waiting outside for the doors to open at 8 a.m.
Man, I've been now for like about 8 months now. I've been looking for a job about 8 months. I mean, it's hard, but you know, so I stay persistent, so... You know what I'm saying? I know sooner or later to come. But I think the economy got it messed up now. The gas prices, got it hard for everybody to find a job now.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I mean, honestly, in the past, I've always walked in anywhere, got a job, you know, and within like a couple of days started working, and I can't believe it's been 3 months.
The same thing. They not hiring. They laying off. Come back later. Wait till September. The same runaround they've been doing for the last month and a half now.
I'm looking for clerical work, and I've been looking ever since January of 2008, this year.
Since March. But I'm a convicted felon, so I'm having a hard time. The way the economy is, and if you're a convicted felon with any kind of violent history, they're not going to hire you. Nobody is. I've went to Wendy's, CVS, Walgreens, Burger King, McDonald's.
Can't find hardly nothing. It's hard.
It's not easy. It really isn't. I'm living with my parents right now, unfortunately. Yeah. So I find my friend wants me to move in with him, but he already has a job, but I don't.
Actually, I go to school now, Everett, and I take a medical assistant, so I'm going into the medical field. So I go every night, Monday through Wednesday, from 5 to 8.
It's hard. You know what I'm saying? You keep looking every day, trying to find jobs, and ain't nothing out there. Waste of gas. Waste of bus fare. It's hard out there trying to, know what I'm saying, get on the bus every day, paying $3 and ain't got no job.
Well, I've been on a few interviews, and, you know, it's like the employees won't call me back and say whether or not, you know, I've gotten the job or I'm being considered for it. They're really not giving me any idea of what I'm doing wrong or if my credentials aren't good enough.
I gotta wait until school starts. That's what they always tell me. And that's when I'm gonna start hiring. So I'm probably gonna wait until that happens, which is like in 2 weeks.
Yeah, well, I had a couple of responses though, but you know what I'm saying, it wasn't the responses I wanted to hear though. At least somebody did call me back though. They did call me back.
We just heard from Florida residents Reginald Wesley, Cheryl O'Connell, Jamarquis Smith, Sean Williams, Tanya Hill, Jazz Travis, and Carlos Perez, who were seeking job assistance at Tampa Bay Workforce Alliance. Reporter Emily Reddy recorded and produced that segment. Today is the 63rd anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima in 1945. The bomb killed nearly 80,000 people immediately and destroyed most of the city. Just 3 days later, the U.S. dropped another atomic bomb on the city of Nagasaki. An estimated 65,000 people were killed in that attack. At Peace Memorial Park in Hiroshima Wednesday, about 45,000 people attended a ceremony during which Mayor Tadatoshi Akiba decried the use of nuclear weapons, noting that some 190 states have signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.